Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Be the Right Club Today podcast. This week's guest is Associated Press golf writer Doug Ferguson. Doug has covered over 100 major championships, including 20 plus Ryder Cups and President's Cups. And in 2019, he was awarded the PGA of America Lifetime Achievement Award. Doug, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, sir. How are you?
Good.
We're great, Doug. We're excited to talk to you. So there's a lot going on in the golf world right now. And, you know, I've spent 25 years out there loving the PGA Tour, thinking that they gave me the platform for everybody to be able to see what I knew how to do. Apparently, the world is thinking differently now. The golfers are thinking differently. And tell us about these two other leagues and what your take on it is.
I don't quite understand one of them, Hal. The Premier Golf League, I think that's what it's called, the PGL thing. When the latest was they sent a letter to agents and players saying, look at all the money you're leaving on the table if the PGA Tour won't give us an audience and we've got this big plan. I'm not sure the PGA Tour owes them an audience. And I think what kind of confuses me a little bit about it is that there's this insinuation that something's broken. And I always got the feeling that things were going pretty good. Prize money's going up, you know, the crop of young players is due respect to your era, Hal. I always thought that kind of that 79 through 81 group that came out was one of the best we've ever seen. But this latest group for the last three or four years is astounding how well they play. Young players, good group of players. They all dig playing. The competition's great. And I'm trying to figure out what's broken that needs fixed. The other one is simply all about money, the one that Greg Norman's behind. I mean, you've got Saudi Arabia basically trying to present itself in a better light, sports washing, some call it. People have different opinions on that. And they're offering more money than you could possibly imagine. And apparently there's an endless supply of it. And, you know, I think the feeling is as long as there's an endless supply of money, there's always going to be a threat. I can't quite put my finger on it. I had one of the players ask me at Riviera, what do you make of all this? And I think he was leaning on going at the time. I didn't have a good answer. I just said, I don't have a good feeling about it. And the more I think about it, the reason I don't have a good feeling about it is money's to be earned. Now, some money comes easily than others. But the idea of just handing out money, just to me, never seems like a good idea. That's all I got for you.
Well, it certainly proved that way in other sports and some guys' careers. You know, when you've got to earn it, money's to be earned. You said it best, you know.
I would give an example of Ernie Els, who famously used the word wheelbarrow way back in the day. You know, the end of the year is the time to get the wheelbarrow out and go with the money. He still earned that money through his great play that made him attractive for people to throw appearance money at. I think that's different than having someone show up and play for $20, $25 million a week, knowing that it's just there to be given away.
Doug, did you ever hear any of the gripes from the players? Like you said, you know, what's broken? And that's one thing that we had Brandel on, and I asked Brandel something similar. What are they trying, other than guaranteed money? Why would they leave? What's the gripe about the PGA Tour?
I'm not real sure, Chase. And that's interesting. I mean, one of the comments, I wouldn't say criticism as much as comments, is about how you could take someone, you know, one of the best in the game, and the guy starts out with zero and no guarantee he gets any money, where the 12th man on the bench at an NBA game may never take his sweats off and get $20 million a year. Well, one's a team sport. There's a couple things there. If that's what you want, I would tell some of these players to go play basketball. And the answer is they can't because they're not good enough. So we're stuck with golf. Not to disparage golf by any means, but I mean, if you want to go play football, if you want to go play baseball, go do it. But the other side to it too, on that guaranteed money, you see guys go take 2 weeks at the beach. Look what's happened between the Masters and the PGA. You've had Koepka and Hideki Matsuyama as an example who haven't played since the Masters. That's their choice. You play with a guaranteed contract, and you're not taking a week off. You're not taking a day off. You're on the hook from March until November. It's just a different sport. I'm not saying one's better or one's worse, but it drives me crazy when you try to compare golf with another sport. It's not like another sport. If anything, it's probably close to tennis. Again, where these guys can pick and choose where they want to play, and it's all performance driven. I think there's a romanticism about that, frankly.
I think the public thinks there's a romance to that, actually. I think there's a few people that think that they ought to get guaranteed money. And I think, you know, there's a lot of guys starting out where, you know, they're spending a lot of money with no guarantee that they're going to make any money. But we all did it all the way through. I mean, I never had a guarantee of any money. I laid it on the line, just like, you know, the part I don't understand is, I mean, and I hate to call names here, but Phil Mickelson wants the rights to his TV rights, basically, is the way I understand it. Is that right?
Yeah, it's. I think Phil is as smart as he is, kind of missed the boat on that. If these guys have ownership of all their TV rights, they're not getting a TV contract that allows them to play for the prize money that they're playing for in the first place. So they want more access to some of their media rights. And I think the tour maybe could have done a little better job and is starting to allow them to use stuff for some of their social channels, YouTube channels, whatever you got going. But to say that you should be able to own those rights would completely disrupt the entire funding mechanism of golf. It's always been that way. I mean, if Phil wanted all his rights for himself, then CBS and NBC and Golf Channel and anyone else wanting to get involved would have no reason to invest in the PGA Tour because guys are taking it and using it for their own game. I don't know where he was coming from on that one, or the $20 billion that he threw around, but $20 billion seems to get thrown around a lot these days.
Yeah, I've been on the board of the tour for a while. I never saw that kind of money thrown around. I mean, we got the report. Everybody gets the report, the annual report.
Yeah.
I mean, every tour player gets the annual report. So.
Doug, what were your thoughts on the Sergio comments from last week?
Sergio is a piece of work. Sergio's got a good heart. I like the kid. He's just, he's still a 12-year-old and a 41-year-old body sometimes. And just got angry. Apparently he had it right. I didn't see it, Chase, but I mean, the timing, I guess, started too early. And at the end of the day, he probably had a case, but, you know, that's what children do sometimes when you don't get your way and you say, well, I'm picking up my toys and I'm leaving. And that's kind of what he said. So he's clearly been one of the guys who's been mentioned quite a bit and looked at quite a bit. And that's, to me, that was nothing more than Sergio probably getting ready to take some of that money and go join whatever Norman's got cooked up, if he ever gets it off the ground. And it was a petulant comment to say, I can't wait to get out of here. So he basically spelled out what everybody knew all along. But look, I mean, this is the same guy who's thrown shoes and removed sand from bunkers when he doesn't like them. He's got a lot of passion. How's that? That's a nice way to put it, isn't it? He's got passion, Chase.
So you said if he ever gets it off the ground, like Norman says, it's going to happen. And eventually they're going to see all this money getting paid and those better players going to want it. That's basically his contention, right?
Yeah. And we'll see. I mean, I've always been curious about how long this can be sustained. In other words, if he gets, Rory described it as a pre-champions tour, which was kind of a clever way of phrasing it and fairly accurate, frankly. So if you get the guys that nobody was going to spend all that much time with at a regular tour event anyway, and it's a very watered down or aging field, how long can you keep going before you abandon? Now, again, if you've got money and it makes, you know, if the Saudis feel like it makes them looks good, then so be it. But, you know, I guess the one thing they're pinning their hopes on is if you take somebody who's 100th in the world as an example, and all of a sudden he's cashing in a $4 million check from winning a tournament, and the more that goes on, someone says, man, I want a piece of that. Norman said it himself. He said he wouldn't mind. I forgot the number he used, but if you get a guy who's 300th in the world wins a tournament, and proper players on their own tours who can beat this guy with one arm tied behind their back, they're going to want a piece of it. That's kind of the unknown, because I'm not sure that's the case, frankly. You know, I think there's still a great appeal of beating the best. And I think that's what attracts, I think that's what makes the best players who they are in the first place, is they love the competition. You would think, Hal, especially in your era and seeing what you see now, how much money can you possibly have? But there's part of me that's always wondered that money is kind of like, it's kind of like fire and wood. You can, a fire can never get enough wood. And if you got money, you can never get enough. And I don't care if you're Mickelson, probably a bad example there with some of the gambling reports, but if you're Dustin Johnson, for example, or Jordan Spieth, and you've got all this money, there's still part of you that's going to want more. I think that's human nature.
Yeah, but those guys, when you've got all the money you need and that you can spend, what's next that's satisfying is beating the best in the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can tell you, you know, I didn't make all the money that those guys made, but, you know, I prior too much prior to Tiger Woods, but I like beating people. That was a lot of fun. You know, I like that more than actually getting the check for having done it. And that's what we spent our whole life trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we didn't spend our whole life trying to make millions of dollars. We spent our whole life trying to beat people.
Yeah.
I mean, the money is a byproduct of beating people.
The great players think that way.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it too. This is kind of a hard thing to admit, Hal, but I think there's great truth to it, that some of these guys who want to sign up and join this league are basically admitting, I can't beat these guys anymore, or they wouldn't be out there. And if you think about the names that you keep seeing, are all people whose either time is done, they don't compete, or they don't think they can compete like they used to, and frankly, have underachieved in the majors. All of them, just about. I don't know where you put Phil on that. Winning six is pretty good, I think. He's also thrown away that many of them. Very similar thing with Greg in that respect. But Sergio, Adam Scott, Poulter, Westwood, all these guys, these are massive underachievers.
So Greg's not going to play this himself, is he?
No, he's still trying to get into the British. Are you kidding? That was one of the dumbest things. I think it makes the media industry look dumber than that Greg says, yes, I'm going to sign up. I'm going to go back to St. Andrews. That anyone would have said, no, Greg, you can't go to St. Andrews. You're too old. You're not eligible. They don't give exemptions for people like you. And when I say people like you, Greg didn't go in 2010 to St. Andrews. He didn't go in 2015 when he could have. Whether he was hurt or not, I honestly don't know. But it's not like he's had this deep commitment and passion to playing the British Open. But all of a sudden, let me say, I'm going to go play and make headlines out of it. There's a big part of it to me in which he's just trying to stay in the conversation.
Yeah, it's almost a marketing scheme.
Yeah.
Keep his name out there.
And then another headline, Greg disappointed when the RNA said no. I mean, if the RNA saying no to a special exemption for him was about as shocking as saying the sun's going to rise in the east tomorrow. It's never going to happen.
Doug, do you think that more players were closer to leaving before the Phil backlash?
That's a good question, Chase. It really is. So the short answer would probably be yes, but there's still something about taking that last step. And so they'd all been entertained offers. Some of them had signed the non-disclosures. Whether they actually had the check in hand, I don't think so. But at some point, you've still got to go sign your name up, and then it's a done deal. And nobody had really crossed that bridge yet. I think that would have been interesting to see who would have actually said, I'm the first, because nobody did. So it's kind of a hard, to me, it's a hard one to answer. I was in touch with a few people higher up at the tour and who was paying attention to their membership. And there were a lot of names that were being mentioned. And from the tour's perspective, they were never worried about them leaving. Information was strictly rumor-based, and it was really hard to get a gauge on it. Phil certainly killed it. There was a lot of, that was going to be a big week at Riviera, it felt like. And his comments really brought some of that stuff to, you know, to light and made people really think about it. You know, I think one of the more underrated parts of that week, Chase, was Joaquin Niemann, because he started the week on Thursday and they asked him about it. He shoots 63 and they asked him about it. And he says, I really don't want to say anything about it. And it kind of left you wondering if he was leaning, because a lot of people in that stable, Sergio, Carlos Ortiz, all together, you were thinking some of them might go. I overheard Joaquin say to Carlos, they were talking about it. And Carlos said, did they ask you about it? And he says, yes. And I told him nothing. And it was almost like an inside joke. And I thought, man, I wonder if this guy's going. So he turns out he wins in a very, I would say, somewhat dominant fashion at Riviera against the strongest field of the year. And he says in his press conference that, you know, winning on a course like this, beating a field like this, having Tiger hand you the trophy, he goes, there's nothing that can compete with this. And to me, that was one of the biggest comments that showed the value of playing in a proper league. And kind of to Hal's point a minute ago, of your main objective is enjoying beating people, beating the best players.
So, Doug, you're one of the most respected writers out there, have been for a long, long time.
Not after today. Go ahead.
All right. Sorry, Doug. We're bringing you down. Sorry.
Oh, no. Hey, listen, it's part of the business, right?
That's right.
You've always been friends to the tour as well. Were they ever worried about this?
Somebody described Jay, and I thought this was a brilliant description, Hal. They said Jay looks like a president in his second term in office. It just looks beat up a little bit. They always say about Jay, there's golf Jay and there's hockey Jay. It just depends on what kind of mood he needs to take. But I think he's handled it pretty well. He does look a little bit beat down by it. And so to answer your question, yeah, I think they're really worried. I think when you know, again, when you're dealing with a group that can keep writing checks and the money's not going to run out, or seemingly not going to run out, that's going to make you nervous. And it was just, it was becoming a disruption and a big distraction. And it caused him to rethink some things. I sat down with Jay, I lose track of time, I think it was this year at Kapalua. And, you know, some of these programs that they were coming up with were in direct response to it. How can we start, you know, looking after our stars? We need to start thinking outside the box. That's one of the things he was saying. Not all of it, by the way. When you talk about the Players' Championship prize money going up, when you talk about the big purse increases, those were always going to be coming along, because they just signed a mega deal with media rights right as the pandemic was coming about, if you remember, back in the spring of 2020. And that money's kicking in. Yes, the prize money was always going to be there. But the idea of this PIT program, or a way to basically pay off the guys that are moving the needles and give them bonuses, yeah, that was probably a direct response to it. And now they're talking about going back to a full calendar year instead of this wraparound season, and saving the fall for some big money invitational short field events that again would be rewarding top players. So it's causing them to think a little bit more about how we can take care of the stars, which to me is always going to be a tough thing to do, because stars change from year to year. I don't know how many stars there are. There's a lot of great players, but you know, who's to say what it's going to look like 3 years from now?
Well, and that's one of the things, like I played mini tours for 10 years and we were talking about this off air. You know, there are so many good Korn Ferry Tour players. There are so many good mini tour players. So if this DP, or if the Live, the tour or the premier, all that, they take some of these players like Sergio and Westwood and all this, there's going to be somebody else that comes along. There's going to be another Will Zalatoris that comes along. Just like you said, in golf, the stars, they're different stars every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And if you expand a PGA Tour field to 300 players, there may not be a Scottie Scheffler winning 4 out of 6 events, just because there's so many good players. So I feel like the tour is always going to keep bringing these guys up. There's if a door opens for more seats at the table, they're going to be filled with really good players.
Yeah. I haven't thought this all the way through, Chase. You're spot on. I actually think one of the hardest things in golf right now would be let's say you were late 30s, or, you know, if we want to make this really personal, if you can go back to Hal, probably, I'm going to get my years mixed up, Hal, but somewhere around, you know, the mid 80s when you went into that deep, dark slump and had to pull yourself out of it. If you had a guy that good who all of a sudden had to go back to the Corn Ferry Tour to try and get his card back, that's a long road, because you get out there and you're not sure you can beat these guys. They're all hitting at 30 past you. They all have all the fundamentals, just need a little bit of polish. It's, to me, it's hard to get back up. I think one of the interesting aspects to this Norman group is if they went after some of these young up and coming players and promised them big riches back before they have any, and tempt them and get them while they're young. The problem is that what makes a young player great is competition. So you take a guy like John Rahm, who just gets out of Arizona State, and everybody knows he's a big-time player. Patrick Cantlay, you could say the same thing before his back injury. Is John Rahm the player he is now if he's not having to face the best players in the world week after week? If he's going to play a pre-Champions Tour field and winning, does that make him better? I'm not sure. And I don't know if I'm making any sense there. But to me, when you get these young guys – you know, Morikawa, Victor Hovland, some of these young guys right now, what's making them great is having to beat the best players. And I'm not sure if they were at a lesser league, if they would develop the way they have.
So we'll never know those answers until another league starts. I mean, you know, if there is a downside, there's not many people at the top. Even on the PGA Tour, that's where the Corn Ferry has gotten so good. And, you know, between the PGA Tour and the Corn Ferry, is that enough places? You know, because there's a lot of really good players out there. I mean, we see them in here. And, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity. And it puts a lot of pressure on everybody when they get we watch them get pressure on them because they feel like they don't have much of a chance. So they got to take advantage of when they do have a chance. So
that's interesting.
Well, and you look at, you know, Corn Ferry Tour Monday qualifying. I mean, it takes 8-under, 9-under to get in. There's 70 players for four spots at two different locations. There's 140 players for eight spots. And I mean, you know, we've talked about one of our players qualified for two in a row, shooting 8-under and 7-under. I mean, these guys can flat out play.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing, you know, Hal and I have talked about when they made it, you know, kind of what is it called, Hal, back in the day when they changed it to kind of guaranteed
all-exempt tour.
All-exempt tour, yeah.
All-exempt tour, yeah. Once they changed it to an all-exempt tour, like, some of these guys that, like you said, that had been out there for a long time, and if they lose their card, they're not going to go back to the Corn Ferry Tour because they can't beat those guys.
Yeah. Jonathan Bird is who I was thinking of, Chase. Yeah. He's a guy that had to go back to the Corn Ferry when he was about 40, and he made his way back. How did that all exempt? Did that start, let's see, 83 is when you won the PGA. Did it start that year or the year after?
Last year, my first year was 82. It was the last year of the top 65. I played 16 weeks in a row because I kept making the cut. Wasn't making any money, but I didn't want to Monday qualify.
Yeah.
So do you guys think that if LIV wasn't Saudi backed, do you think it'd be as big of an ordeal?
It'd be a tougher, I think it'd be a tougher question, Chase. I think that's a big part of it is you know, the source of the funding. But then tell me this, I mean, what other group out there would be willing to throw out that much money trying to compete against a tour that's in pretty good shape in the first place? I mean, to me, the only reason it's a threat is because of the source of the money, and the source is a big part of it. I mean, this other group is promising 20 million play for every player, and, you know, equity ownership, and we're going to take care of the Corn Ferry Tour guys as well. I can't figure that one out, by the way, if you're promising equity shares to a guy who may not make it. And if he does make it, might not make it more than a year. I mean, as you said, everything is changing and the turnover is so great. I don't understand that model at all. But no, to your point, I think that's one thing people have asked quite a bit. If it wasn't Saudi, would it be that big of a deal? It would be a different conversation. For sure. And I, you know, frankly, you know, what Westwood said last week, and it's the stuff that no one wants to talk about, but it's true. If this money is so bad, why wasn't it a problem when it was part of the European Tour for 3 years? Why is it a problem now? And I think Europe is going to have to whether that's Keith Pelley or whoever, is going to have to come up with a better answer than what they got right now. It's a fair question. And you can make the same case too. And I, you know, listen, it's go deep into their human rights and Khashoggi and any number of things. And there's another party that says, well, at least they're trying. Now, if it's sports washing, it beats not doing anything at all. You can make that argument. It's just, it just comes down to every person's beliefs and what they want to stand for. And if they're willing to back up their decisions.
You use the word equity, promising equity. Equity in what? There is nothing right now, right?
No, that's what I can't figure out. And yet this guy insists on having an audience with the tour in which Jay's going to get paid off too under this plan. He's going to be a part owner of this thing too. And everyone's going to get rich. I'll be honest, Hal, it sounds like a Ponzi scheme to me, but I haven't studied it that closely because I just don't think it's going anywhere.
Well, a lot of those
guys tour are
rich.
Yeah, that's true.
Depends on what your definition of rich is, but.
Yes. Yeah. I don't see that the tour owes it to have an audience with this thing when they've got enough on their plate as it is, but.
This is a question that has to be asked, and you may not know the answer to this, but you know, one of the most valuable things that I got from the tour was my retirement plan. Hmm. There are people that are playing right now that have huge money in their retirement plan. Does the tour still has control of that until you get to be old enough? I don't know. That's probably a question for the tour, and they probably wouldn't give you an answer on it because they don't know what they're going to do, I guess. But
well, they can't. I mean, in terms of withholding it from someone, you can't do that if they sign up for this league. That'll get them in some deep trouble. But I think it's one of the more overlooked parts of the tour. Golf Week magazine back, I think, Hal, it was around 2000. They did a big piece on this deferred compensation plan and everything that Vic Gansey kind of organized back in the day. And I think at the time they even had Stuart Appleby projected at getting $100 million. I always remember his name standing up thinking, man, it's what a great life. But I asked Tiger at Riviera specifically, do you know how much is in your plan? And he said, no. And I said, do you want to know? And he said, no. And I don't know. Even his agent, Mark Steinberg, said he doesn't want to know either. That's just kind of not the way Tiger's thinking. But to your point, there's a ton of money in there for a lot of people, and it gets overlooked in terms of what these guys are getting. And, you know, the other thing too, Hal, you talk again, and here comes the guaranteed pay topic, and here comes the 12th man on the bench in an NBA game or a guy who's, you know, playing in the NFL. You're looking at a career on average of about 6 to 7 years. Golf's more like 25. And that can't be understated. As long as you're a good player, I'm not saying necessarily a great player, but if you're good enough to compete every year, win every third year, keep your card easily every year, you're playing and accruing with sponsorship and opportunities for 25 years. That's what the other leagues can't give you.
I agree with that.
A great point. All right, can we segue into? Into our next topic. We've got a major championship coming up on a really, really good golf course near and dear to my heart. I'm an Okie, so I know. And I think you actually, I saw you graduated from Oklahoma. Is that right?
I spent more time at Oklahoma in graduate school than I did at Abilene Christian. I would have. I'm that guy that didn't finish his thesis, Chase.
Okay. Gotcha. I thought I saw some ties to OU. But anyway, got a major championship coming up at Southern Hills. Who do you like?
I never know. You know what, I tell you what, Chase, not to dodge it, which I'm about to very artfully here, but whenever I get the who do you like, I always think back to a show of hands at Olympic Club in 12. Who had Webb Simpson that week? These guys they're too good. I have no idea. Amazing thing about golf is not only do I not know who's going to play well, I'm not even sure the players know they're going to play well. So I think it'll be an interesting week for Spieth, though. I think, you know, this guy's got a keen sense of making history, and I think it's a good course for him, and I think he's starting to control his ball a little bit better. His putting always looks good. I mean, to me, when Jordan starts missing the two-footers, that's when I know his putting's well. I don't know what Hal thinks about this, but the more I've watched Jordan, he reminds me a lot of Mickelson on the greens. Mickelson, to me, had one of the more beautiful putting strokes from 15 to 25 feet, but get him inside 5 feet and boy, he missed a lot of them. I see Jordan missing a lot of short putts for some reason, but the overall stroke is good. So, you know, he's one I would look at. And I don't know, Seven Hills is such a great golf course. You know, I pointed this out yesterday, the last five winners at Seven Hills are on the Hall of Fame. That tells you a little bit about the golf course. The other thing too, that's interesting about it is that we've never really had any close ones there at Seven Hills. The only one that comes to mind is the 0-1 open, and that's Retief's fault. If he had just two putted from 12 feet instead of three putting and Stewart Cink having that unfortunate, we had the playoff with Brooks and turned out to be a mess. But this to me is really bizarre. They've had seven majors at Southern Hills, and every single winner there has had the lead or at least a share of it from 36 holes on. You've had Raymond Floyd going wire to wire, Hubert Green, Tommy Bolt. Tiger took over with that 63 on Friday and never got caught. And so it's always been a front runner type of a golf course. I did not answer your question on purpose. How did I do?
Terrible. I'm so disappointed. Such a political.
They're all good, Chase. I don't know.
I'll talk about your experiences with Southern Hills and just thoughts on the golf course.
It's a great golf course. You know, it's got, do you think it favors a ball moving a certain way? I didn't think it did whenever I played it. Do you think it did? I mean, there's holes that you need to fade it. There's holes you need to draw it. There's blind shots on it. I think the 18th green, if they haven't softened it, is one of the toughest finishing greens I've ever putted on. Olympic Club. You know, Olympic Club's got that serious 18th green, too. I mean, it can get away from you, and you hit a good putt there. So, but anyway, one of the things that I would say is we played that most of the time in severe heat. And they have a chance that it might not be severe heat this time, although it's already hot down here in Houston. So it probably will be up there, too.
It'll probably be easier for them to control the golf course right now versus in August.
Right? You're getting a ton of rain from people I'm hearing down in Tulsa right now. A ton of rain, which I'm not so much thinking about soft as much as I am getting the grass to pop a little bit more this time of the year. I think Hal's right, though. You know, I'm just in my head. I haven't been there since 07, but it's one of my favorite courses. And it seems like there is a lot of movement, a little bit subtle, right to left. Yeah. Left to right, you got a lot of elevated greens. I suppose this is true at any golf course, but distance control seems tantamount right now. And there's a lot of runoffs too. Gil Hance came in and did some, I think restoration's probably the right word to kind of put it back to when Perry Maxwell first did it. That creek that for many years, I think the growth of trees kind of took the meandering creek out of play. And I think it's in play on the outskirts of play. In other words, if you come off a green and you catch a slope you know, it could feed down there pretty close. It makes you think. I think guys who were there in 94 for the PGA who hadn't been back and see it next week, I think they'd be in for a surprise. I think it'll look differently just because of the way the creek and the stream have really come back into play a little bit more.
Well, teeing off on the first hole, looking at downtown.
Yeah.
Doesn't get much prettier than that. You know, it's got quite a setting there.
It really does. It kind of reminds me too, Hal, a little bit of I want to say a Brentwood Riviera type thing, only from the standpoint that you basically have a world-class golf course carved into a square section of a neighborhood.
Right.
Basically of a downtown. We had a broadcast executive for the AP who was making a sales call back when I was stationed in Tulsa many years ago, big golf fan. And it was January. So the Bermuda, everything was dormant. And he said, yeah, I think there's a golf course down the street from my hotel. Yeah, it looks okay. I could just kind of see it through a chain link fence. I said, yeah, that's Southern Hills. It's hosted six majors. It's pretty good.
Yeah. It is good. It'll be fun watching.
Yeah.
Doug, talk a little bit about your thoughts on Scheffler's run.
I can't put my hands around it. I'm sure he can't either. Here was another guy who was always going to be good. And in other words, you talk to Randy Smith and Dallas and the people that played with him at Texas. And there was never a question about Scotty. It just, you know, took him a year or so to win. That's not unusual. You say the same thing about David Duvall back in the day, as good as he was. But Scotty's a gamer. I think he's got great hands. And I think what's shaped him, the more I listen to him, is his ability to watch and his ability to listen. Randy tells some delightful stories from Royal Oak of having a lot of tour players. And I'm not talking about pro mini tour, but just proper tour players. And Scotty is a kid who would just sit there on a flipped upside down bucket of balls and just listen to him tell stories and then try and compete against him in chipping and putting contest. And the guy had a desire and he had a goal that he was never going to take his eye off. And the rest of his game is really come along. His footwork is unique, works for him, putts well. I would just say there's no big weakness in his game. I thought his short game was ridiculously good at Augusta. We could talk a little bit about him chipping in on three, which is a bit of luck with the hole getting in the way, or he's really in trouble. But that chip he hit from behind the first green was insane. I mean, that's to me one of the hardest chips on the course. The putting's good, and he is one of that's the golf side of it, Chase. The part to me that stands out more is between the years, because this kid is so competitive and humble at the same time. And the one thing we keep hearing about Scotty from people around him is that he'll never change. And you can see that, even though he's still young, 25, I think, you could see that this guy is not going to be any different if he wins the next five tournaments or if he loses his card. Same guy. A lot to like about him.
That's powerful.
So, Doug, I believe there's very few people that could have played from where he played from off of the green at Augusta and finished in the top 10. I'm just telling you right now, that's how good his short game was. I mean, every time he chipped and pitched, he almost had a gimme.
Yeah.
And I mean, let me tell you, the hardest place in the world to chip, Augusta. Mm-hmm. Tightest lies, fastest greens, most undulation. I don't have to tell you, you've seen it all the time.
No room for error there. Yeah.
No room for error.
At the end of the day, based on what you're saying, Hal, the guy had, I can't say he didn't have any stress, but he had a lot less stress than he should have given some of the positions he was in. And I think from what I've seen over the years, what really adds up at Augusta is your stress level. It just keeps you on edge the entire time. And the less you flirt with it, the better off you're going to be.
Doug, you've covered Tiger a ton. Give us some of your favorite Tiger stories.
Wow, that's loaded there, Chase.
Very loaded. You didn't answer my one question, so I'm going to get you.
I don't think Tiger's going to win. But I had to do something for a buddy of mine in Tulsa, and his deadline was in late March, and he's asking me questions about Tiger and whether we're going to see him. I forgot what I told him, but I think there's part of me that might have said, you know, I don't think we're going to see Tiger this year. And he shows up at Augusta 3 days after deadline and he's playing and I'm looking like a complete idiot that I am, but Tiger's so hard to predict. It's unbelievable. But I don't know. I you know, what's funny. There's a ton of them. I spent an awful lot of time around them, and probably the reason for that, Chase, is because he didn't really have a lot to say. Hal can attest to that. And I don't blame Tiger for that. Some guys like the other guy on the podcast, right now was very eloquent and could really explain things beautifully, and some guys don't. So I used to get up every morning around 6 and walk pro-ams and practice rounds with them at the majors, because trying to find something different to write about, because you're going to have to write about them all the time. So many stories. His performance level back in the day, and I still think back to Hal actually talking about him, Tiger putting his pants on one leg at a time, just like the rest of us at the Players Championship that year. That was one of the funnier moments and one of the great performances. I think back to his iron play. There's two things to me, Chase, that don't get enough attention. his putting is incredible. I mean, him and Jack probably go down as two of the best putters of all time for big moments. Everyone talked about his power early, and they should have, but his iron play, once he got that dialed in with Butch in 99, was a part of his game that was never talked about enough. The control, the shape, the different flighting of his ball was, and still is, just sublime. That part always stood out to me. And the other part too was the Masters versus the British Open. I always thought Tiger's best chances were on links course as much as it was Augusta. There's a small group of guys who have always been good at Augusta, whether it was Crenshaw or, you know, modern day, you would maybe favor a Spieth, Tiger, obviously. But his imagination and creativity on links course was unbelievable. So you're asking for a good story, then I will tell you one. I used to do this story every year on the major champions, and I would ask them about kind of the moment everybody remembers from the major they won, and what was a moment that was particularly special to them that the average guy might not pick up on. I gave Tiger 2 months to think about it, and this would have been St. Andrews in 2005. And he finally gets back to me and he says, does the driving range count? And I said, what do you got? He goes to warm up for the final round, and they used to have these wooden signs for the on the range with 100 written on them, you know, kind of like an old Muni. And Tiger said with his first four wedges, he not only hit the 100-yard sign, he hit the middle zero on the 100-yard sign with the first four. And so Hank Haney, who was working with him at the time, says, he whispers to Steve Williams, he says, if you guys get to 100 yards on the course, you might want to tell him to aim away from the pin. So I said, when did you first get 100 yards? And he said, the sixth hole. And I got to thinking, and I thought, oh my God, Tiger hit the pin with his wedge, skirts off the green, and instead of having to kick in for birdie, is having to scramble for par. Wow. And I said, what was the next time? He said seven, but that was a hole where you didn't want to aim at the flag anyway. So when you start talking about precision, you used to talk about that 2-inch draw he hit on 12 at St. Andrews one year. I always think back to the driving range and the 100-yard sign. That was pretty remarkable.
That's great. Great story.
That's a great story right there. You know, Chase has heard me say this. He didn't have any weaknesses. And, I mean, to me, most everybody – had a fear that they didn't want to leave it in a certain place because they knew that would be a weakness of theirs. I thought he approached every shot fearlessly because he knew he had the next shot, whatever it was. Now, that's freedom. If you can do that, that's a freedom that nobody else is able to play the game with. Yeah. And, you know, I got to see him play a lot of times, and I really thought that's the way he played golf.
Yeah. That's a nice
I didn't play
point.
Off that way, by the way. I had places I did not want to put the ball.
I always think back. Hank got a lot of criticism, and he still gets lampooned a little bit for any number of reasons. But he, I thought he was spot on. It was a really bold comment to say, and this would have been around 06 or so. And he said the weakest part of Tiger's game is his short game. And everyone said, Hank, you're out of your mind. And then he explained, and he was actually, he made a good point about this. He said, if you put Tiger in the deepest, darkest spot on the golf course, he'll hit it to 2 feet. But you give him a stock chip just off the green where a guy, you know, a good tour player could think about holding it or at least having a tap in. And Tiger would hit it to 5 or 6 feet and sometimes miss the putt. And so I was out watching him about a week or two later, and I thought, geez, he's right. He was just right of the 12th green at Riviera on not the fringe, but kind of that short collar, pretty standard chip, one short side or anything like that. And he hit it to about 5 feet. And then you put him behind a tree with six elephants in his way, and he nearly holds it. And I think to your point, Hal, when you know, no matter where you go, you can get out of it, it frees you up. And he was in enough troublesome spots that he could do that. But to Hank's point, which was kind of interesting back at the time, if he had a pretty standard chip, he was just pretty okay. I wouldn't call that a weakness, by the way. I'm with you. I haven't seen too many weaknesses there.
No, I haven't seen too many weaknesses. Doug, you've been great. we really appreciate you being on. You've given us some insight that we wouldn't have otherwise not had.
Just didn't give you a PGA winner. Sorry, Chase.
Well,
you kind of gave us
stuff that they're doing. How does anybody predict who's going to win? I mean, if you're standing there watching them every week, how are you going to – the game's too hard to predict that.
I had an epiphany as it relates mostly to my business from Jim Furyk. When he was at Firestone one year, he's had a couple close calls, and he opens with a 65, and we're writing all these glorious stories about redemption is in order, and he's going to atone for the close calls, and this will finally be his week. And I thought to myself later, if we wrote the way players think, the story would have said something like this. Jim Furyk shot 65, only missed two fairways, hit the ball pretty well. Got himself, saved par the few times he was out of position. Hopes he can play this way tomorrow, but he has no idea what kind of game he's going to have. But if we wrote that, we wouldn't be able to put ads anywhere. So we got to come up with something. But the amazing thing is about this game that I keep saying is you just don't know from day to day what you're going to get, what game you're going to have. And when you don't have it, how you're going to find it. That's the fun part of the game.
Yeah. Doug, real quick little follow-up to that. What's one thing you have access to all these players behind the scenes, all this stuff. What's one thing that that you've learned from them that the public doesn't know? Like, one of the things Hal and I talk about is like tour players mentally are fragile, just like a 10 handicap is. Like, they have the same demons. They struggle with the same stuff. What's one thing that you could give our audience that you've witnessed behind the scenes that the public doesn't see?
I think that's a big part of it, Chase. How much they badmouth themselves. And sometimes I think it hurts them. And sometimes it's to inspire them. Sometimes it's to really fire them up. I hear that. Used to hear from Tiger all the time. You suck. You're such a bad putter. Imagine Tiger saying that. From more of a broader sense, I guess you see things from here and there. I wouldn't really put a thread on or a generalization on all of them, but I've been thinking about for the last 5 years, the problem we have in our business, not just mine, but all of us, sometimes we know too much. And what I've found from people over the years when they say, oh man, Mickelson, his name's come up, for example, oh, he's just the best, isn't he? And you just kind of go along with it. And I've seen enough from Phil over the years that I've got my own thoughts on him. But for the general fan out there, when they really love somebody, let them. Their fans don't ruin it for them. I would say, I know we're trying to wrap it up here, but I would double back to Phil on one thing that I find odd is he doesn't seem to have a lot of support from the players. I don't find too many people that are really rallying to his defense, and it just raises the question, why? How would know? He would have seen enough to know some of this stuff, I guess, but it goes back to the other point too. Sometimes whether you're in the locker room with your fellow players or whether you're passing through the locker room as a press guy and you see things and you see behaviors and look, nobody's perfect. But you do get a sense of who they are.
Well, I think you mentioned it when you talked about Scottie Scheffler. He's humble, but competitive too. It's hard to be competitive and humble at the same time. And you have to be selfish to be good. And some people take that to an extreme. I'll leave it at that. you can take that any direction you want to. Doug, you've been amazing. We appreciate you. I always love talking to Doug first and everybody. I always felt like Doug was fair. And I can't say that about everybody that was pushing a pencil, but I always thought Doug was fair. So thanks for being on.
You're kind. Appreciate that, Hal. Chase, thanks for your time.
Be the right club today. Yes!